Hey, 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 Pop Culture Quorum Deo, coming back to talk to you about some Haunting of Bly Manor. I am Jeff Wright. I'm here with the good Dr. Jared Moore, and we're together in studio. This is a nice run we've had. We need more episodes, but I enjoy sitting down and talking face to face.
Absolutely.
How you doing, man?
Doing well. It's good to be here.
How's that book doing?
It's going well, seems to be. Saw the Gospel Coalition Australia reviewed it, and then I did an interview with Daniel Darling a few days ago, Owen Strand a few weeks ago. A lot of good coming out of it, it seems, and I just want to get it in the hands of the church and hope it's beneficial and helpful.
Yeah, so that book, if you're not familiar, listener, is The Pop Culture Parent. There's an episode in our archives just a couple episodes back where we talk about that book. Jared's collaboration with Ted Turnow, Mr. E. Stephen Burnett. Great book. Totally recommend you go track that thing down. It's funny listening to you run through those appearances you've made. So Gospel Coalition, Australia, Dan Darling. I know you were on with A.D. Robles and Matt on Reformgelical. So I can't figure out if you're now part of Big Eva or the guerrilla effort against Big Eva.
I hope I'm part of all of it.
So can I call you Big Gorilla?
Call me Postmodern Big Gorilla. I just love everybody.
That's it.
Joe Osteen, Postmodern Big Gorilla.
You're the full-blown third way.
There you go.
Well, I hope everybody reads your book, and it's really good. And I'm thankful y'all wrote it, and I hope it sells all the copies, not just to make you super wealthy so that you can build us a sweet studio, but because I think it's really helpful to the church, and people are looking for that kind of resource. You ready to jump into our first segment here, sir?
Yes, sir. Dive in.
What you watching? What you watching? What you watching?
So, Jared Moore, what you watching?
What have I been watching? I've been watching football. NFL.
Liberal.
Yeah. I've been watching football. Been enjoying that.
I thought on a previous episode we swore off sports. Is that not what happened?
No. I still watch the NFL. I mean, my son, my oldest, like it.
Well, I was still watching college football until the Tennessee Vols showed me that all they want to do is break my heart forever. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I knew that, man. I'm watching the Titans, though, and they're wrecking my heart a little bit, but they're also winning some games. So I think they'll make the playoffs.
For sure.
I've been watching Fargo some. I can't recommend it. You look at the conscience stuff on it. But, I mean, it's well done. It's just that there's a couple parts that are turn-your-head parts where you know what's going on. I don't think there's any nudity, but it's disturbing, some of those stuff. But I mean, as far as drama, it's well done and story, and they know how to tell a story.
I've watched all of those so far, all the seasons, mm-hmm. and every time I've let them all get done and then watched them all, you know, like binged them. Mm-hmm. So
Chris Rock is doing amazing.
Yeah.
I do not like Chris Rock. Generally, not a fan, but because he's obnoxious. I'm not a fan of that obnoxious approach to comedy, but he does really well in a serious role. And I actually watched Witches on Netflix, too.
That's the Anne Hathaway thing?
Yeah.
Is it good?
It's a remake. And, I mean, we might need to cover it on the show because of the clear draw difference between good and evil.
Oh, yeah.
There's a stark. Like, they make the witches nasty, looking ugly, and, you know, they look beautiful on the outside when they got all their wig and everything on. But when they take all that off and reveal who they truly are, it's sinister.
Well, see, here's the thing, Jared. I love Jesus more than you, and I canceled Netflix over cuties.
You haven't signed back up yet?
I haven't, no. I thought Bly Manor would do that for me, but I was able to be afforded the chance to watch it without having to sign back up. And so,
gotcha.
I'm joking. I will definitely watch that. And I did cancel my Netflix over cuties, but I will also figure out a way.
Did you watch the old from the 90s, Witches?
I have, and I knew they were remaking it, but I may need to watch both of them to even remember it because it's just been forever. Witches have never been my jam. You know, I loved, I think it was Eggers, The Witch, mm-hmm. even though it's got some conscious stuff in it too. But mm-hmm. it's the one where it's basically a Puritan family living out on the edge of civilization.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
The daughter is corrupted.
It was good.
It was really good. So I'm not saying they can't be done well, but it's just not my jam.
This is a kid's movie.
Yeah, okay.
And so it's, you know, it's meant to be fun with kids, but also to warn them about. And
so is it just about Planned Parenthood?
It's got for real. But it's got Spence. Is it? I want to say Spencer Octavia, but that's wrong. What's the lady's name on this horror movie, Mama?
Oh, that's Spencer Octavia. Oh,
okay.
Or Octavia Spencer. I think
Octavia
you got it backwards.
Spencer, okay.
Yeah. But she played Ma.
Yeah, she plays her grandma in this
And she
one.
Was in The Help?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's great. And so she's in this new Witches movie. And then Chris Rock's narrating the child.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, yeah. So it's really well done.
Do you think kids could watch it, or is it?
Yeah, they can. It's just when I was a kid, it scared me. So I assume it'll scare your children, but it's good to point them at a point. I mean, it's good to say witches are scary. I mean, if you have a category for that, because they'll find it in the Bible. And so me, don't want them to lose sleep at night. But, you know, these things are real. And so, I mean, you know, they're not real like the movie says. But I do like how, like, you know, paganism or dark arts are portrayed in an evil, like clearly evil light.
Yeah.
And even so, the kid loses his parents. That's why he's with his grandma. And he's moping around and stuff. And she's like, I don't feel sorry for you. And the good Lord decided to take him. I don't understand it. But it was like
a throwback.
It was like, yeah, it was like blatant, like divine providence. This is how you rightly think about losing loved ones and suffering. And I was like, whoa.
Hey.
Like she did a real good job. But then she goes in her little voodoo closet and does like some sort of
cool.
There's good magic and bad magic.
Yeah,
you know?
That's okay. That's true in Tolkien.
Yeah, yeah. But it was just funny because she goes from there clearly expounding scripture and walks in like
this. The good Lord took him, and it's, you know, it's his prerogative to do so. Now let's go worship Samhain.
Yeah, not quite, but it's just funny.
Yeah.
It was funny.
Well, I'm going to watch that. I may watch it with my kids. Did you watch it with your older kids?
We watched it with all of them.
Okay. I may watch that with them because they'll want to watch something scary this weekend. And Mandalorian drops tonight as we're recording. So we've got some good stuff to.
We need to do. Did we do an episode on that?
I don't think we did.
We need to remedy do it that. For 2 seasons. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's clearly an adoptive dad at this point.
Yeah. Jeff actually has a signed picture that I found on eBay because the dude spelled, the dude who was selling this autographed picture spelled the actor's name wrong. And I can't remember what I got it for. It might have been like $10 plus shipping. But
it's dope.
It is awesome.
Yeah, it's super dope. My youngest son is dressed up. Well, my youngest son who's out of the womb is dressed up as the Mandalorian for Halloween this year. And thank you for that gift. It's super cool. I'll put a picture of it, listeners, in the show notes if you all want to check it out. Jared's a generous friend.
It was cool. It was cool. Like, I love getting, I don't care. You know, people may be. The company I got it from seems legit, but, you know, yeah. People can, they may be sitting down and signing this stuff themselves and putting it on there, but I don't care, man. Just thinking like, hey, I've got this autographed picture.
Yeah, autographs are cool. I'm still a kid, you know, collecting autographs from basketball players was the biggest deal in the world.
Oh, yeah, man. I love it. It's like you got a piece of what they got.
Well, kids are great for that, too, because you can, like, tell you, like, hey, go get that autograph. It may be for you. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. You're going to, like, store it and put it on your wall, but your little fresh-faced kid can go get the autograph. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, man, grow up. Hey, for what you're watching, I'm going to switch it to what you're listening to. Did you listen to my interview with Colin Samuel about UFOs?
I did. That was really interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was super interesting, too. He's a good guy. That's an interesting topic. There's a documentary out right now that I think it's like $20 to rent, but I'm going to do that. It's called The Phenomenon, and it's about UFO information that's coming out. You know, some of the stuff we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been reading on the subject. My cards are on the table. I think that if we find extraterrestrial life, the church should assume demonic deception, but keep an open eye or keep an open mind that maybe there is extraterrestrial life. Like, let's start with what we know and work to what we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I've just been reading on the topic, and my kids, you're talking about like kids dealing with evil and whatnot. That same middle son, he's six. They knew I was reading some UFO stuff. My older kids were like super interested because they don't really know what UFOs are. But my oldest son is interested in the same way I was in the paranormal and things like that. So he's read some things and he knew that I was reading it anyway. So my kids started asking me about UFOs and we watched the new Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix episode about that one UFO encounter. It was in the first batch of episodes that they released.
Hmm.
It happened up in like Massachusetts. And so we got done watching it. My youngest son was pretty freaked out. And so we sat down and I'm like, Dad, what are UFOs? And I walked him through the whole thing. I walked him through. They could be extraterrestrials. I don't think that's likely. I think this is probably demonic and it's a demonic deception and that they probably do mess with people. Mm-hmm. Or at least it's entirely possible that they're doing something to people, you know. And my son, I wish I could convey it to you. He was like taking these big breaths and rubbing his eyes and he just looked blown away. And he was. I mean, it's a it's a staggering thing to come to grips with. Like, we live in a world of unseen intelligences, mm-hmm. and they might be able to interact with us or mess with us, right? And so he had a rough time. I could tell that his world was getting bigger very quickly. But we got a chance to set that night. We probably spent an hour and a half talking through the biblical worldview, talking about the sovereignty of Christ, that our family had pledged our allegiance to Christ, and that Christ is not afraid of demons. Demons are afraid of Christ, that we're under his care. Nothing happens to us apart from his good choice. And I mean, it was rough on my son, but I was really thankful for the conversation and the chance to kind of be the first voice at the table on that subject, mm-hmm. which is kind of what I hope that podcast does. I want to be one of the first voices to the church if we do end up having the U.S. military or Marco Rubio or Tom DeLonge come out and say, yeah, we've got extraterrestrial technology. Mm-hmm. You know, I want Christians to be prepared to think through that and have someone speaking to it.
That makes sense.
I'd like to ask you, we've had conversations off air that I think are really interesting and helpful too. I don't want to spoil them all here, but there's a good movie, I think, on Netflix right now. It was when I canceled it, called Dark Skies. It's got Kerry Russell in it. Mm-hmm. And if you'd be up for it, I'd like to review that and then us have a conversation about your thoughts on the extraterrestrial question.
Sure, sure.
Okay,
cool. Yeah, I'd love to do that. I'll just say briefly that we've talked some. I think, you know, this could be demonic influence, and it could be both. It could be actual beings or entities that are created or that are part of the fallen creation that just aren't mentioned, you know, in scripture. And but even that, they wouldn't have a savior because they're not human. They're not image sure. bearers.
Christ did not take up their nature and die in their place.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it doesn't, they would be part of, and they may be more intelligent than us. Just like angels are not image bearers, but they are more intelligent than we are and can evidently
do stuff we can't.
Do stuff. I mean, be fast, strong, stronger. I mean, and so there may be other entities that are similar. That are out there, but that it doesn't change anything in the Bible.
Well, let's let that be a tease then, sure. and get into that more. Have you read Michael Heiser?
Mm-mm.
Unseen Realm, Reclaiming Hermann. He is an Old Testament exegete. I'm still trying to get my head around him, you know, because he makes statements that nobody else that I've read make. And I've since found scholars who are in a similar vein. But I think what it is, what's going on is that he's on a developing edge of Old Testament exegesis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think he's outside of orthodoxy. I just have to also vet him against my tradition and my, you know, my understanding. But at one point he talks about how the Nephilim existed in the conquest of Canaan in Joshua's day.
Mm-hmm.
So how did they exist if the flood wiped them out? And he says it could be, one of the ways it could be is that angels or demons who were doing whatever they were doing with the daughters of women recreated that activity after the flood and sort of began the process again. And so there's a couple different, you know, you talked about like these could be part of a fallen world order. They could be direct creations of God who chose to put them in his cosmos. They could also be some kind of strange genetic experiment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of options on the table. So, again, that'll just be a teaser. We'll get into this more at length.
So you lean towards that interpretation that the Nephilim were actual copulation, result of copulation, angels and humans?
I never have. I've always seen that as basically impossible because of the problem of hybridization.
Mm-hmm.
Some species just can't cross, right? Like you can make a horse and a mule because the genotype is close enough. I say a horse and a mule, a horse and like a zebra, you know. You know, there's like ligers that exist where a lion and a tiger has bred a hybrid, but they're basically sterile and they can't reproduce after that. And so I've just assumed that angels and humans were too incompatible to reproduce genetically.
Mm-hmm.
But Heiser makes an interesting case. And so I'm willing to countenance it.
Yeah, I wonder, like, you think of the incarnation and you think of obviously human sperm that, I don't know what's going on there with Jesus.
We don't want to get into, I think one of the Mormon early guys was like, God the Father impregnated Mary.
Yeah.
We don't want to go there. But are you saying that maybe there's a compatibility between the spiritual?
No. I'm saying that I just wonder if us saying that, it would have to be that God designed it to where these two would work together.
Oh, sure. Well, that's what I mean by compatibility. Not that any doctrine is compatible with false doctrine, or that sinful nature can wed up to holy, but that it may be a design feature that we just haven't discovered in God. That's what I mean by compatibility.
But it would have to be like, I mean, like the human examples that we have, they would have to, the angels would have to manifest themselves as humans. We assume they don't have like male, female parts. And so they would have to manifest themselves. And if they manifest themselves as human, it's not like they are angels that now have angelic human sperm. It's
exactly
like they have vocal cords, human vocal cords. They have so everything that comes out of them is truly human, we assume. And so if they are copulating with females, they have to become human or at least manifest as human in order to do that. And so,
With the Nephilim hypothesis, though, of like angel-human hybrids,
mm-hmm.
they communicated some kind of strange physical characteristics because you see, you know, the line of descent. So with Goliath, who's really tall, there's another guy who I think has like six fingers and toes on each appendage. And so, you know, if the hybridization hypothesis holds,
mm-hmm.
something distinct from humanity has been genetically transmitted. And that's where I've always come up short. That's where mm-hmm. I've come up short and said, I don't think, you know, even a shapeshifter, I can't imagine they could spread genetic material. And I think that then raises all kinds of questions about federal headship,
mm-hmm.
right? Because federal headship's passed down from the father. There's all kinds of problems with it. That's why I've rejected it. Heiser just makes it enough of a case for me to go, okay, I'll hear you out, you know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I said that'd be a teaser.
I think MacArthur is right there, lockstep.
Okay.
At least he has been. Like, he believes that. He believes that the Nephilim are, like you just said.
Well, we'll do some research then. Maybe bring some of these guys to the table.
Get Johnny Mack on here. That'd be great.
I'll just call him up. Yeah, I'll do that.
We do know one of his elders.
Yeah. I've talked to a couple people's church by this point. I know Mike Riccardi, I did an interview with him for the CRV podcast. So.
But what I was saying about the incarnation, I was just meaning that we assume that it is true humanity.
There. Sure.
Like that's the only, just because of the source or, you know, it doesn't
means
change.
Means of creation.
Yeah. It doesn't change. And so I'm just, I don't know, looking at that with what's going on. And the angels did have power, it seems, like you think of blinding the sodomites, you know,
mm-hmm.
and but was that a miracle, or was that something they still possessed? Are they appearing as human, or do they manifest as truly human? I mean, there's all these things, you know, that are hard to wrestle with. But
yeah, it seems more ambiguous in the text, right? That, you know, the point of Genesis isn't to tell us who the Nephilim were. The point of Genesis is to tell us, where did Abraham come from?
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes we go to those texts and ask the wrong questions and feel like mm-hmm. there's not enough data. We're just bringing the wrong questions to the text, but it is of interest, and God included it for a reason. I'll just tell you, as I went down this rabbit hole, just trying to suss this stuff out and see what the options are on the table, it goes in a lot of different directions. There are people who think that, for instance, the Sasquatch phenomenon
mm-hmm.
is somehow a throwback to the line that came out of the Nephilim, went through, mm-hmm. you know, basically Goliath's family tree. And I'm not trying to lend credibility to any of that. I'm just saying there's a lot of people out there thinking through this that I was surprised to find. You know, there's people who are seriously thinking about this who are not mentally ill, basically. You know, they're not irreputable people.
Have giants been dug up anywhere?
Yeah. So we've got some skeletons we can't explain, at least as far as I've been able to read as a layman. I have to send that to you, and I'll try to bring that to the episode, because, you know, there's some people who are like, well, that's a pre-human hominid, or, you know, there's... Anyway, there's just some material I need to suss out. But yeah, we have some skeletons and I think some skulls that aren't super easy to explain by really anybody. So, yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, we'll try and talk more about this at length in an upcoming episode. But you brought us to a good transition. So if you're cool with it, I'll wrap up what you're watching here and we'll move into...
So sorry to interrupt!
Told me you wanted to challenge me today on a subject that's near and dear to my heart. And so let's just jump into it. Jared, Christmas sucks.
Christmas is better than Halloween.
Well, then for that to hold true for me, I would have to say that Halloween also sucks.
I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah. All right. Well, lay your case out and I'll try to get my head around it, because
Christmas has better stories, one. Christmas has more redeeming stories. Christmas has... Christmas has Jesus. Christmas has, you know, God becoming man, the incarnation to save folks, has the best music.
Oh my gosh. If you say movies, I might knock you out of the chair.
Are you kidding me?
Yes. I mean, excuse me. No. Christmas movies are a scourge on humanity.
Are you kidding me?
Not at all, dude. There hasn't been a good Christmas movie since Die Hard. Maybe, maybe Christmas Vacation.
Maybe?
Yeah. I don't remember actually which one of those came first. One of those is the last good Christmas movie.
You're crazy.
All right.
So, Home Alone's great.
Yeah, it's yeah.
Home Alone's great.
It's okay.
It's wonderful.
What? It's a wonderful life?
No. Well, yeah, A Wonderful Life is good.
Maybe. I mean, I'm not... Yeah, my criticisms aren't...
Okay, good. So why is Halloween better?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know if Halloween's better. Reformation Day's better, for sure. Reformation Day is better.
You're moving the goalposts.
Well, I'm just trying to go through a depth chart, because my family loves Halloween. Now, my family loves Halloween. I mean, excuse me, Christmas, too. And I'm kind of an outsider on that. But we all together love Halloween. We just also love Reformation Day more. So we spend more time on Reformation Day. So I'm just trying to go through a flowchart. Here's the thing I'll grant you. The originating source of Christmas is infinitely better than anything Halloween can rise to. Okay. But my problem with Christmas is the corrupt way it is practiced in Western culture. And so in some ways, I would like to be a big fan of Christmas. The things I like at Christmas are being with my family and being with our church. Our church handles it as an opportunity to pay special attention to the doctrine of the incarnation. I love doing that. I love singing with them. I love the songs we sing at that time of the year. Although I try to push our church to say, look, if they're worth singing at Christmas, they're worth singing every, you know, season. And so we don't just talk about the incarnation at Christmas, which is one of my problems with Christmas. It kind of becomes a ghetto for all the incarnation stuff. So like, yeah, we tend to pigeonhole everything into Christmas, and then we leave the incarnation alone for the rest of the year. The problem I really have with Christmas that I don't with Halloween, they're both crassly commercial, but Halloween, when you celebrate it in crass commercial terms, you are not creating a counterfeit of something good. And so what I hate about Christmas is the rank sentimentality that we're all forced to participate in. And they stretch it out so long in terms of marketing that by the time you actually get to the day of Christmas, I'm exhausted. I don't want to hear another Christmas song. I don't want to see another snowy Norman Rockwell painting. If we came into Christmas for basically 30 days, I think I'd be a big Christmas fan. Mm-hmm. If we as a society didn't just limit our practice of it, but we were actually trying to reflect on the incarnation, I'd be a bigger fan. But the way we do everything is a distraction from those things, and it ends up burning me out. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, there, like you said, it is a good point that the counterfeit is counterfeiting something good. But with Halloween, you're counterfeiting something evil. But it's not like you're declaring it righteous or you're redeeming it. You know, the evil elements are still often part. It's almost. You know, Halloween says that both Halloween and Christmas say that there is a supernatural world.
Absolutely.
And
well, intrinsically they do.
Yeah.
I don't know that the way we express them culturally does. That's my problem. Mm-hmm. And so, like, Halloween is not nearly so much a bastardization as what we do with Christmas. And that's where my objection to Christmas is. Like, what you just said is right. We have taken the supernatural incarnation of the second person of the Trinity, mm-hmm. and we've said, let's make it about sentimentality and giving each other gifts. And that, to me, seems like a real offense. So anyway, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but...
I think those things can be done even in a way that, you know, why do we give gifts? Because God gave the gift of His Son. Like, I don't think that... I mean, for example, my church, folks are... benevolence is brought to the forefront. Precisely because the Lord has, I mean, omnibenevolence is on full display in the incarnation. And I think that's something that's very good. I mean, Christmas is fun. Halloween is fun, but they're fun for different reasons. I mean, you know, giving gifts can be redeemed. And
absolutely. Like, and what you just said is where I'm at too. I like the aspect of it that I get to participate in with my church and my family,
mm-hmm.
because I think there is an effort to say, this is actually about the incarnation. We're trying to reflect the character of Christ, and not just reflect it, but just have the joy. Like, what happens when something good takes place? A baby's born, a new job, something like that. We give each other gifts. It's a way to celebrate. I'm with you entirely. I just want to Benedict option that thing and cut myself off from Walmart and Target and Amazon and the radio and the Hallmark Channel and all that stuff and say, leave me alone. And I just can't do it. I can't drown it all out because it becomes a sea of sentimentality. I'm going to pull out a big gun on you. Let me just read you a couple quotes. We, like you, no doubt, are in the climax of the Christmas rush, a time which I always regard with horror. I hope I am not a Scrooge, but with every year that passes, I find myself more and more in revolt against the commercialized racket of Xmas. That was dated December 1952. How wretchedly the Christian festival of Christmas has got snowed under by all the fuss and racket of commercialization. November 53, I feel exactly as you do about the horrid commercial racket that has been made out of Christmas. I send no cards and give no presents except to children. Do you know who those are from?
Mm-mm.
And there are more. I could keep going. That is from one Clive Staple Lewis.
Mm.
When I discovered that C.S. Lewis felt the way I did for the exact same reasons about Christmas, it was quite a comfort to me. I felt delighted. So, and really, that's it, Jared. I'll never argue that Halloween's better than Christmas. But Halloween also isn't a corruption of something beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I celebrate Halloween with my family, what we're doing is saying Jesus Christ is Lord of the supernatural realm. What you may see is sinister and dark and evil. He's Lord of, and we're under his care. Our allegiance is to him. This is not something we're frightened of. We're celebrating, right?
Mm-hmm.
That he is the Lord of these things, that the rule of this world has been cast out, and these things we brought under Jesus's feet. And I'm going to act like they're under his feet right now, because guess what? They're under his feet. But the stakes are lower, because it's just a pagan holiday that we kind of participate in shallow ways. With Christmas, you're actually losing something eternally valuable when it turns into the Hallmark version of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where my objection to Christmas comes, and why I say Christmas celebrated in the advanced modern West sucks. So did you win the debate or did I?
I will let the listeners decide. Yeah. I think I did, though.
You probably did.
But with Halloween, we're doing the same thing. We're mocking the principalities by making light of, like, my kids this morning, the youngest, one of them's Mario and one of them's Luigi. They look awesome, man. And then my daughter was a hippie. And then my son is too cool. He just turned 13. He's too cool to dress up. So,
and then, like, at some point, he'll get cool enough to start dressing up again.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like the C.S. Lewis thing, where hopefully you'll grow up to the point someday where you read fairy stories again.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll dress up like Star Wars characters next time we go see a Star Wars movie.
Yep.
Or something. Or Avengers, or, you know, yeah. He loves that stuff. But with Christmas, we are restoring what has been forgotten and trying to reject the materialism, even as we could give good gifts to the children.
Well, yes and amen. And I affirm every bit of that, brother. And that's probably the approach I should take. Like, all right, I'm going to show y'all I'm going to show you our church, actual Christians, like-minded families. We're going to show you why Christmas is special. I should have more of a reformer's mindset, but I really feel, I mean, you know me, I'm happy to be in a good fight, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm happy to trade jabs and barbs and things like that. But I feel like I'm washed away in a broken snow globe the size of the Himalayas when Christmas shows up basically around the time of Halloween,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't really peter out until, you know, a couple days after New Year's at best. I just, I feel overwhelmed. I'm not used to feeling overwhelmed, and I feel overwhelmed.
I enjoy some sentimentality is good as far as a general principle. Like, you think of, you know, where the gospel goes, often human flourishing goes.
Sure.
And sentimentality helps to encourage human flourishing, or it can. But you look at Halloween, and there is no, I mean, is this, I mean, does the pop culture, for example, around Halloween usually help encourage sentimentality? You know, what would it encourage? It's more of a dark time, even though there's a clear good and a clear evil.
Sure. You're absolutely right. I won't object to that. And it's a way for people who are interested in dark things to normalize expressing that interest. That's not a good thing. Right. I don't celebrate that. And I don't encourage that, or I'm not happy that happens.
Sure.
I just feel like Halloween is a chance to have a laugh that Jesus Christ is Lord. And I feel like I can't hear anybody having a laugh that Jesus Christ has come at Christmas because it's being drowned out by white Christmas and these things that are just, you're right that sentimentality is good. I think sentimentality appropriately can express gratitude for the past and even a willingness to receive the wisdom of the past, right? That there are things that are good in the past we should carry on now. But it seems like Christmas is sentimentality for sentimentality's sake. So we're not thinking about the blessings of home and family so much as we're thinking about a snowy Thomas Kincaid picture or Norman Rockwell picture.
I don't think there's a giant divide between those myself. Like, I think you can think of both. Like, or the Rockwell can be redeemed if it's underneath the...
I think a thoughtful Christian can redeem it. I just don't think that... I would go the other way and say that our culture is deeply disconnected from the authentic good of the past that should be celebrated in Christmas. Mm-hmm. And it may be more pernicious because it looks subtle on the surface. You know, again, White Christmas is a great example. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. I mean, what the flip does a white Christmas mean for anything? It wasn't a white Christmas in Bethlehem. You know, it's not a white Christmas, I'm assuming, in Australia, unless some kind of, you know, climate change has happened that I'm not aware of.
But think of the aesthetics, though. Like the, I mean, think of the Christmas decorations versus Halloween decorations, or even Christmas trees. And
yeah, it's closer. I get that it's closer outwardly. I can't go much further with the meaning that's actually being expressed and what people are participating in. I have more of a hard time with that. I mean, at this point, I'm probably being too stubborn and dancing around the mulberry bush with you. You're not wrong about anything you're saying. I just think you have to go to a pretty self-conscious, culturally aware, and culturally... I'm trying to say, not just culturally aware, but like willing to be contrary to the culture kind of Christian to get what you're talking about. And I just think that's few and far between. But I mean, if I had to pick the joy of seeing my kids go trick-or-treating and come back with candy versus the joy of seeing them tumble into the living room, read the Christmas story, open gifts, see family, never in any known potentially infinite universes would I pick Halloween over that.
Mm-hmm.
Halloween just, to me, isn't replacing something good with something counterfeit, just to bring it full circle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a major part of why I have criticisms about Western expressions of Christmas.
Makes sense.
All right, so we want to put a bow on this. Listeners, we have the Pop Culture Quorum Deo Perpetual After Party Facebook group. It is designed for you to weigh in on the things you hear on the podcast. So get on there and let us know. Am I a godless pagan for not loving Christmas? Is Jared basically Thomas Kincaid? Get in there and let us know. Well, Jared, we're here to review The Haunting of Bly Manor. Are you ready to pull the curtain?
Yes, sir. Pull it.
All right. So, spoiler alert, guys. You know how we do here if you've listened before. We get into the details of the plot. We analyze it from a Christian worldview. We figure out what's good, what should be rejected. We try to show you how Christians can enjoy, but also not be discipled by pagan storytelling. And so, I'm going to read the IMDb summary of The Haunting of Bly Manor, and from there, we'll be in full spoiler territory. Jared, IMDb says, after an au pair's tragic death, Henry hires a young American nanny to care for his orphaned niece and nephew who reside at Bly Manor with Chef Owen, groundskeeper Jamie, and housekeeper Mrs. Gross. Supernatural hijinks ensue.
That sounds like a comedy.
Yeah, ghost Home Alone. Anything you'd add to that description?
That description isn't very good. Supernatural hijinks, yeah. I would say a tale of deception, terror, and love. That sounds soap opera-y.
Yeah, sinister haunting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is definitely a sinister tale. Have you ever read The Turning of the Screw that it's based on?
Mm-mm.
There was a very awful adaptation of The Turning of the Screw that was released before the quarantine. I can't remember exactly when, but it was called The Turning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a good movie. It has no ending. It has Finn Wolfhard in it from Stranger Things and Muschietti's It. But it's awful. Don't go near it. It's just a bad movie. But anyway, around the time that came out, I saw it. I checked out The Turning of the Screw. And it's a good story. Mike Flanagan, the guy who directed The Haunting of Bly Manor a couple years ago, did The Haunting of Hill House. And I don't know, I mean, listener, you can go back and listen to our episode in the archives. I don't know that I've loved a series any more ever than I have loved.
Really good.
The Haunting of Hill House. It's hard for me to think about Bly Manor without thinking about Hill House.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those deals where I wanted Bly Manor to be as good as Hill House, but it wasn't. And so it's hard for me. I mean, I tell everybody, Bly Manor is really good. But man, compared to Hill House, there's just a lot left on the table.
They hyped it a little too much, Bly Manor, like scarier than Hill House. And I saw some statements like that when they were filming them. I was like, whoa, like it was not.
Not at all.
Not even close.
Yeah. This is much more of a drama.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's just jump into it. And we want to go through the creation, fall, redemption, glorification motif here to kind of think through it. And so, Jared, what do you see that's true and good and beautiful in The Haunting of Bly Manor?
Flanagan's a good storyteller.
I mean, sure.
Being able to string together 9 episodes that tie together, that, and this one, similar to Hill House, you got to get 3 or 4 episodes in before you really start. It's kind of a slow burn, but, you know, it makes you enough there to make you want to watch the next episode. He's a good storyteller, and he puts these Easter eggs, these ghost appearances enough to have you wondering why.
Yeah.
And then he ties it all together in a beautiful bow in many ways. And it's strange, though, because sometimes you're kind of drinking from a water fountain, and then some episodes just like a fire hydrant.
Sure. Right.
And I kind of like that. That's how it was with Hill House, and that's how it is with Bly Manor. It may be just his storytelling, but if you're doing a 10-hour movie, and that's kind of how he views it, if I remember correctly, he views it as a 10-hour movie, which is wise, you know, to because that's how a lot of people, they're, binge-watching this. And as far as true, good, true, and beautiful, I think there's a clear good and a clear evil. Even in, you know, the adultery is frowned upon, for example. Even the villain, she is, or the ghost, the evil ghost, she is not put in a positive light. I mean, her jealousy is basically the reason why all this is going down. Her jealousy, her rage. So unrighteous anger is viewed as unrighteous. All that is good and true. And then there is, I was going to say there's an emphasis on love, but it starts out in the beginning as love, and then the husband's love for his wife. But then, you know, once she dies, there's this new marriage, and the ghost is jealous. But as far as I can tell, his view of marriage is not warped. Homosexual marriage, right, is obviously warped. But I don't think he's frowning upon heterosexual marriage. At least he could have made that man and woman cheat.
Sure.
While the girl was still living.
Or abuse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But jealousy, it seems to be the vice that is really condemned here. And I think the Bible is, you see that with the serpent in the beginning being jealous of God, and then being jealous of man and tempting man. And then, Genesis 3:15, there's going to be enmity between you and the woman's seed, talking to Satan. And so there's this constant jealousy the evil one has towards man. And but the man is going to crush his head, the man, Jesus Christ, and he's going to bruise his heel. You know, that jealousy is condemned here, and I think we can celebrate that. And there's a distorted view of love. But, you know, the sibling love that the children have for one another, even the adulterous uncle, his love for the children, even though it's a type of broken love, but he does not hate the children. He wants them. He's worried about their care. That's something we can celebrate.
Yeah, I in some ways, like, the good in Bly Manor is getting moral corruption right. Now, that falls apart on a particular theme, which I don't know if it says good things about Mike Flanagan. But to your point, the sort of central haunt of Bly Manor is a woman who has rejected God's order. Mm-hmm. She has elevated herself over and against God's sovereign plan as creator. So when it comes time for her to die, she refuses. And I mean, that's our culture to a T. We want to pretend like death won't exist. It won't come for us. We will spend all the money in the world trying to buy 15 extra minutes of life. We will put all the chemicals in our bodies to make us look like we're not subject to aging. Like if we could be Olivia, I think was her name. If we could be that central ghost, we would be. And she sort of is a parable of that. And the fact that she rejects God's order, meaning that she refuses to leave when she dies, creates a perverted, corrupt environment that sucks other people into it, right? Like, yeah, that's exactly what happens when we reject God's order, even thinking about death as an enemy. Now, I love Flanagan. You know, you talked about what a great storyteller he is. I love everything I've seen from him. He is a great world builder. But I do wonder if these things we're talking about, where he clearly has a sense of the moral order, but now we're starting to get evidence that he wants to accommodate progressive ideology. He's trying to be self-consciously progressive in his storytelling. I'm starting to think that maybe he's going to lose his fastball. If not, what makes him an incredible storyteller?
Mm-hmm.
I have no doubts he's on board with progressive ideology. His stories just haven't reflected that particularly.
Mm-hmm.
And the more he leans into this, the worse it's going to go for him. I thought that this movie values family. This movie values parents and children. Like, children need their parents is a thing. But we also have sort of this adoption motif that it's good for other people to care for children in desperate circumstances. You can build it by caring for one another and sacrificing for one another. You can build meaningful relationships that sort of look like family, right? But the problem with this is that eventually it terminates on a counterfeit family. And that's where it kind of falls apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's nothing else you're thinking about under the heading of good, we can move into what has fallen. Where are the idols? How do we tip them? And that's where I'm going to go to. I'm going to go to, you know, by pinning at the end of the series, an entire episode dedicated to two characters in a lesbian relationship. Flanagan has made the story about these two lesbians.
Mm-hmm.
And he even gives them the trappings of marriage. Like at one point, because it's set in the history of the West, one of them comes to the other and says, I know we can't do this legally, but I want to marry you. We'll wear rings. And then later on, we see a scene where, hey, I went and got the paperwork done, so we're in a civil union. Like he's walking them through the progressive narrative, but it just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And it ends up corrupting the story the same way that, you know, that's the irony here. By rejecting God's order for human relationships, he's ruined a good story. Mm-hmm. In a similar way that the mistress of the house rejecting God's order of, you know, it's appointed for each man once to die and after this face of the judgment, Flanagan's replicated the error in his own story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, amen.
So what else are you seeing there that's idolatrous and false?
I don't know. It's almost like it's not false. You could say it was a good. That's what we were talking about. It was the good.
Yeah. And I said that maybe on the point of natural order, we could switch to the bad.
Gotcha. You know? Gotcha. The good is, this lady was a staunch feminist matriarch, the villain. Hmm. I mean, it seems that way. And
she was definitely going to be lord of her own life.
Yeah. Lord of her own life, lord of everybody else in her life, you know, and in sickness. Humbled her. It should have humbled her, but it didn't. It just increased her rage that even in death, she's going to rule everything. And so that's what the ghost is. And, when she enters, Danny, you know, she's going to control her life and
ruin it.
And eventually Danny, decides, and that's something else that's evil in this is the suicide, as if I'm gonna go take my own life so I don't harm my
lover.
My lover. And I just it's interesting how Flanagan is telling this love story, and the only categories he has for presenting a lesbian relationship is by robbing from heterosexual love stories.
Marriage.
And so he has to make it like a heterosexual marriage. Like there's nothing distinct about same-sex marriage except that they're the same gender. And they actually rob from, what civilization and the Bible has said love is to be. It's odd, isn't it, that they deny what marriage is while simultaneously saying, well, we believe love, you know, husbands and wives, like what, like should still be same-sex marriage. You should still be faithful to one another. Should not be adultery. And it's interesting, the marriage is, the old marriage that he presented was good. There was love there. But then the adulterous relationship that he presented, and then this one, there's this, even death can't do them part. Like it's almost like lesbianism is
transcendent,
transcends heterosexual marriage,
yep,
type thing. Like they're, even though she's gone, she still loves her and leaves a door open for her, like she's going to come back.
And Danny's hand's on her shoulder. So in some ways, Danny's still with her, even though that's what I mean. Like this has broken his world.
Yeah.
Because Danny has to be at Bly Manor to keep Olivia pinned down or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But Flanagan tries to pull her in to still being with Jamie. You're spot on there. And that's the tale with same-sex mirage, right? That's where they give their case away. Because same-sex mirage is built on the only thing that matters is that we love each other. And that is the union that binds us. And that's the same thing that a heterosexual couple has, right? But they insist that it's legitimized by the ceremony and covenant appearance of a marriage, mm-hmm, right? So they want to have their cake and eat it too. I need the objective validation of this being identified as what has globally and historically been known to be only given to one man and one woman.
Mm-hmm.
Even as I want to tell you also at the exact same time that my love is self-defining and self-legitimating. And that's where they give it away. The whole legalized marriage movement is an attempt to reconcile a conscience with something that a conscience created by the one who creates mankind can never be ultimately satisfied with.
Mm-hmm.
So you're absolutely right. They have to go and steal from the thing that exists outside of them, God's gift of marriage,
mm-hmm,
to try to legitimize their attempt to live as if all they need to do is express themselves authentically and love who they want to.
Mm-hmm.
And again, with Flanagan, it just shows up. You can't do this. I think, too, the point about feminism was really good in that it's also a rejection of natural order.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where his story gets broken, too. Who am I supposed to root for and see as the good guy in that story that sets up the haunting of Bly Manor?
Mm-hmm.
The first wife is miserable and awful and clearly rejecting even God himself. Now, that actress is Mike Flanagan's real-world wife, and she's a great actress, beautiful woman, very powerful actress. I think maybe he thinks we're supposed to come away seeing her as a powerful woman, sort of the feminized ideal, but she's awful. She's a hag.
Mm-hmm.
She makes everybody miserable. I mean, by the time we get to Danny, she's basically the mom who's participating in Munchausen by proxy.
Mm-hmm.
Am I supposed to see the second wife as the good guy? Well, she killed the first wife because, mm-hmm, she grew tired of her abuses. There's nobody good here. There's nobody to celebrate here. Everybody sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And you've not told a good story if the character who's supposed to represent strong femininity is a monster and the kind of monster that sucks everybody into her orbit, nor is the other person supposed to be the hero because they're a murderer. You know, it's attributed to Chesterton that it's a truly evil story that has no truly evil people. I feel like that's basically all Hill House is.
Mm-hmm.
And it brings the story down. You know, Peter Quint is the more contemporary.
Not Hill House, Bly Manor.
Sorry, Bly Manor. Right. Peter Quint is supposed to be the bad guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we see him stealing and trying to possess kids, like truly monstrous things. But Flanagan feels like he needs to go and stick a scene in where we find out that Quint's been abused by his dad and his mom was terrible and tried to, you know, was the one who manipulated him into stealing and all this stuff. And you're like, you know what? Everything's not shades of gray. And if you want to try to tell me a story that's all shades of gray, this is probably the best you can do. But I'm always going to come away less satisfied.
He may be leaning towards that the patriarchy has produced all this, you know, like the reason why the mistress of Bly Manor was the way she was is because of the world she lived in. And, you know, it just makes me.
I hadn't even thought about that because Peter Quint's dad is ultimately the corrupting influence on him. His dad abused him. His mom was acting as like not on his dad's agency, but just sort of in light of who his dad was, you know.
And then
you're right.
To save marriage, it would be. Get men out of it. Only lesbian relationships
are like pure and
like you said, transcending.
Yikes.
Even beyond death. Death doesn't do its part.
Yeah, but you know what? Again, Flanagan can't tell that story,
mm-hmm,
because where does Flora end up?
in a heterosexual marriage. Yeah.
What makes this a sweet story is that Flora ends up happily ever after with her Prince Charming. Hmm. Flanagan can't even be satisfied.
When he's married, he's in a heterosexual marriage.
Yeah.
But he always puts his wife, well, not always, but in Hill House, she was in a lesbian relationship.
She was a lesbian there. In Hush, she's just a single woman. We don't know anything about that. But, I mean, she's a gifted actress.
She's good.
But Flanagan clearly feels a need to sort of honor homosexual perversion. And he can't pull it off.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense because it can't be pulled off in the real story.
Mm-hmm.
So is there any redemptive element in this?
I mean, if the girl didn't commit suicide, you know, giving her life for others to protect others is always praiseworthy. But the concept of I'm going to go drown myself to hold this, you know, and he's trying to argue that love conquers all. I mean, he's that.
And you know, trying to celebrate self-sacrificing love.
Yeah. Right. Which is ironic, isn't it? Like you're trying to rip the gospel off.
Well, that's the whole thing in that lesbian mirage. Jamie's going to sacrifice long-term happiness by being with possessed Danny until possessed Danny's taken over, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's all those stories about we'll just be together now and we'll have now and that'll be enough, mm-hmm. right? So Jamie's giving that up. Danny goes and kills herself so that the thing she's possessed by doesn't hurt her lover. Mm-hmm. And again, yeah, it's all what you just said, a counterfeit of the gospel.
Yeah, but if love, I mean, the hole in the story is if Danny can in death control Olivia, why couldn't she in life? You know, does she gain more power in death? You know, I just there is a hole there. He's wanting to paint a beautiful story, and he's wanting us to be sympathetic towards to see homosexual relationships as legitimate, but also not only legitimate, but as potentially better than heterosexual relationships.
Yeah, it fails.
Yeah.
You know, he's basically replicating our current cultural project, and it flops.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I told another friend of ours on a different podcast that it's easy for me to think of Haunting of Hill House and Bly Manor as comparable to Jordan Peele's Get Out and Us.
Mm-hmm.
In that, I think Haunting of Hill House was pretty close to perfect. The ending was a little weak. He didn't quite stick the landing because he doesn't know how to provide heaven,
mm-hmm.
right? But it was pretty perfect, and the story was internally consistent and buttoned down. That's the same deal for me with Get Out. Get Out is internally all buttoned down and internally consistent. It's pretty much a perfect movie.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we get to Us, things have gotten more sloppy. It's well told. It's pretty. It's interesting. But there's just some sloppiness to the narrative. So I don't want to give too much away, but like, what do the doppelgangers in Us do when the person they're replicating flies across the country, right? That question's just, or flies out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
That question's just left hanging. I feel like Bly Manor is that too. Bly Manor does a lot of the same stuff in a beautiful way that Hill House did, but it just ends up being more sloppy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the whole point is that Olivia, I think that's her name. I feel like I'm getting
that's right.
something confused. Olivia will not leave Bly Manor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she is so powerful, she traps other ghosts there so that when like Peter Quint possessing someone tries to leave the grounds, he's sucked out of whoever he's possessing. Well, why is she willing to once Danny has her? It's just arbitrarily, okay, now everybody gets to move off the property, right? And so he just can't do it. He can't deliver it. And she, and what we've already talked about, she wants to, she's got to be on, Danny has to be on Bly Manor grounds to keep Olivia pinned down. But somehow Danny's able to have her shoulder on Jamie's, have her hand on Jamie's shoulder far out. And so I guess if I was going to say anything redemptive without just continuing to belabor the problems, the redemptive thing here is that he wants to tell a story about self-sacrificial love. Henry's going to provide for the children he's been cut off from.
Mm-hmm.
Danny is going to sacrifice on behalf of Jamie and basically everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to get there, but the redemption is weak, and so the story is weak. And you come away going like, well, maybe, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
You think that's fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Well, what about glorification?
Yeah, I mean, there is no hope for glorification in this one. I mean, you know, if you're going to justify Danny taking her own life to protect Jamie, then why doesn't Jamie go and, you know, go and be with Danny?
Yeah.
I mean, if that's, you know,
mm-hmm.
If that, I don't think Flanagan wants to say that. I think
he tried, right? Because Jamie tries to drown herself and can't.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, he realizes, I can't make her just killing herself work. That would be awful, too. There'd just be layering tragedy. So, she ends up being an old widow who's pining after a dead lover. And it's supposed to be beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's what I'll tell you about glorification, man. And this is why I think it tells you about the real world accidentally. There is a glorification here. The glorification comes for Flora. Flora forgets Bly Manor. She goes to live in the real world, right? And where does she live in the real world? She lives in the real world with her husband. And so the redemption here, or the, rather the glorification, isn't found in Flanagan being able to successfully pull off the delusion that lesbian counterfeiting is equal to heterosexual marriage. It's found in leaving that nonsense behind, right? The character who gets a happy ending is Flora. She forgets the nonsense of Bly Manor and goes to live in the world God created. Now, Flanagan would hate me for saying that, but that's what happens. And honestly, that's the way the church is going to have to welcome refugees from the broken sexual moral world we live in. Yeah, you went and all that destroyed you, right? You thought it was going to make you happy. It didn't. You thought you were going to thrive. It crushed you. You thought you were going to flourish. You withered. Leave that mess behind. Come over here into the world as God made it. And I mean, we're going to have a whole bunch of Mike Flanagan screaming that the real world isn't the real world. But people are going to get burned out and they're going to look for the truth.
Oh, yeah.
And the church has to be there to say, actually, let me tell you a story about a wedding. Maybe or maybe not for you entering into a heterosexual marriage, but a faithful husband who marries his bride and keeps her for eternity.
Amen. I mean, yeah, the gospel is infinitely better.
Yeah, so that means really that's what we need to kind of wrap up final thoughts on.
Absolutely.
We want to talk about how the gospel is better. So what comes to your mind?
Well, I mean, Jesus laying down his life for sinners, but he died at the hands of lawless men.
Also, it wasn't a suicide.
Right.
You know, he was executed by lawless men, but also according to his father's will. This isn't suicide. That's a perversion of what Jesus did.
Right, absolutely. Perversion of it, like you said, to, you know, to dress his bride in white, to cleanse her, purify her, keep her eternally.
Yep.
And, you know, and not only that, but he is Lord and going to, so he's not still in the tomb like Danny's in the lake, you know. He's out of the tomb. He is Lord over the tomb. There's no one holding him down. Death could not hold him. It was given 3 days, according to the Jewish definition of days at the time. You know, what it was a matter of hours, 30-something hours. But he is Lord, and he's returning soon, and the everyone's going to know it. Every listener, I mean, everybody's going to know it. And it is a much better story, much better story. There is no resurrection in this movie. There's no eternal resurrection. There's only
ghosts.
Ghosts, yeah. Ghosts.
And it's fading memory.
It supposedly transcends, but it doesn't. It's much worse. It's less than, not more.
Yeah, and so that's where I'm going to go to. There's two false Christs in this story that help us appreciate the real Christ. The first false Christ is Olivia, who thinks she has power over death. And her rejection of her mortal status ends up becoming a gravity well that traps others in her rejection of the natural order. That's a false Christ because Christ's actual death and resurrection catches up all who believe into his resurrected life.
Man. Well, and not only that, but it catches everyone up just in a different way. Like he is like preaching Colossians 1:15-20 this week and this Sunday, and he reconciles all things to himself. It's just everybody knows he's Lord. His lordship catches everyone up.
Right. So the gravity of who he is, right? What Hebrews calls, the phrase just left me, but it basically says an indomitable life, a life that cannot be constrained, catches everyone up into a beautiful future, not a morose British countryside hamlet. The other false Jesus here is Jamie. Jamie has a wife who is infested with death and destruction that is waiting to kill her. And Jamie can't be a good enough husband to deliver her wife from that. It's going to claim Danny. Jamie is a false husband and is going to kill her wife. But we are betrothed to the husband who can deliver us from the internal corruption that is going to kill us. And so you look at Olivia and you say, you are a poor savior. And you look at Jamie and you say, you are a poor husband. And it gives you the chance to turn right around and look at the one who catches us up into his glory and who is able to powerfully deliver us from the death within us.
Amen. Amen.
All right, man, we got to wrap it up. We got places to go and people to see. You're at Jared H. Moore on Twitter.
On Twitter. Come find me. Come talk to us.
Yep. I'm at Right Jeff on almost all social media platforms. You will find us at PC CD Pod on those same platforms. We mentioned our Facebook group. Get in there and come chat us up about this. We'd love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review on whatever podcast platform you are currently listening to this through. Go check out Jared's book, The Pop Culture Parent. And we'll be back to talk about maybe some more UFO stuff and theology with Dark Skies here pretty soon.
Amen.
And until then, this is Jeff Wright on behalf of Jared Moore, encouraging you to live every moment as if you are before the face of the Lord.
Because you are.
Talk to y'all next time.